using the same debt to equity. If the numbers go to subsidiary, use different debt to equity. I think, like the Disney case, I didn't used to say, there I didn't even have subsidiaries. I allocated the debt across five businesses. So where is it said you have to use the same debt to equity? And different behaviors and different costs. So how do you get the debt to equity ratio? Well, you've got to estimate it one way. The fact that you don't know equity doesn't mean you can't estimate it. So it's up what, 16, 17? Okay, folks. I'm going to start with a reminder. I mean, I don't mean this to be a downer, but a week from the coming Monday is the third quiz. Okay? Wait. You're saying, how come so soon? 2 weeks from that Monday is the last day of class. We're almost there. It's 3.5 weeks left. So there's no other place to put the third quiz. It's got to come between now and the end of the class. The class is essentially coming to its climactic moment. And I want you to be ready. Which means this might be one of the last weekends you have of space. Use it, okay? Use it because starting next weekend, it's not just this class. Everything's going to start coming at you in a rush. So I don't want you to be kind of hanging out there in the last week saying lots of stuff to catch up on. So tomorrow I'm actually going to gather everything together and send you kind of a to-do list on this is where you, what you need to get done to get to the end of the project. Print it off. Pin it up on somewhere and start going down the to-do list as you go along because you need to do it incrementally. It'll be overwhelming. When you first sit there and say, I've not done a thing. I know none of you are there. Actually, a lot of you probably are. You're going to say, it's too much. I'm not even going to get started. So the to-do list will say, do it incrementally. One step at a time, you'll get there. So trust me. Every semester I've taught this class, I get to this point. You're exactly where most people are in this class at this point in time. And every semester I've taught this class, I've dragged every last person across the line by the end of the semester. And that'll happen here as well. Okay? So if you haven't picked a company, don't laugh. There are at least 6 people in this room right now probably who haven't picked a company. I won't name names. I don't even know the names. Just the laws of large numbers suggest to me there are about 6 people. Pick a damn company. Don't say there's one. You're not Hamlet, right? He could never make up his mind. Look what happened to him, right? So try to make a decision. Move on. So I'm going to go back to where I left you on Monday. Okay? So on Monday, we were talking about the question of what's the right financing mix for a company. And I ended with this question of, if I came to you with a bank or an investment bank or an insurance company and asked you this question, okay, it's a tough question to answer. Partly because defining debt for a bank and an investment bank is very difficult to do. So I said, turn the question around. Rather than ask, does my company have too much debt? What's the question you need to ask instead? Does my company have too little equity? It sounds like the same question, but it kind of frames the question differently. Because for banks, investment banks, and insurance companies, having too little equity is judged against some regulatory equity requirement that they have to have. Let me ask you a question. Why is everybody chatting still? Class is on, right? So have banks always had regulatory capital requirements? Now, until the Great Depression, banks were allowed to do whatever they wanted. And then you had the Great Depression, and the regulatory authorities woke up and said, this is too difficult because if depositors start losing money they put into banks, it creates a crisis. So regulatory requirements were created in the 1930s. Were there banks before the 1930s? Yeah. The Rothschilds go back to the 1300s and the 1400s in the U.S. So if you did not have regulatory capital requirements, how did those banks operate? Did they keep? Do you think they kept capital aside? I mean, if you were the Rothschilds, it's 1550, you've started a bank. Do you think they kept some kind of capital aside? Yeah, I think they did, because that's the way they survived. The capital they set aside was to cover any potential losses they could make on their loans. Regulatory capital predates regulatory authorities. And in fact, there are three ways you can run a bank. The first is what I call the regulatory minimum strategy, which is you think of this as saying, the regulatory guy tells me this is how much I need to keep. I'm going to keep exactly that amount. Not a penny more, not a penny less. Why? Because if I keep too much, then it's tying up equity, so I'm going to go to the regulatory minimum. That sounds like a pretty good strategy, right? There's a law. I'm keeping to the letter of the law. Why are you taking issue with me? What's the danger of being at the regulatory minimum? Did any of you read the news story about Goldman Sachs over the last couple of days? What did the story say? That Goldman Sachs, the last of the banks to settle the charges coming out of the crisis, and at least nominally, it's a $5 billion settlement. By the time it's all said and done with all the tax things, you're probably going to come to a $2 billion settlement, right? Now, when Goldman Sachs has to pay $2 billion, where does that $2 billion come from? It has to come out of the regulatory capital they've built up. If you're at the minimum, do you see what's going to happen? The minute you have the $2 billion fine, you're now below your regulatory minimum and you're in crisis. You're saying, that's no problem, I'll go issue shares. You're issuing shares just after a news story has come out about you. That's not particularly good. So that's part of the reason most banks try to keep a buffer over the regulatory minimum, because they know that things can go bad, and things go bad, they don't want to end up having to raise capital the worst of times. So, if you look at aggressive banks, they tend to push the regulatory minimum. Conservative banks tend to build a buffer. And the more conservative they are, the bigger the buffer will be. There's a trade-off, though. By having the bigger buffer, you have lower returns on equity. Why? Because you have more equity tied up. There are some banks, and these, I think, are the really sensible banks, that say, look, there are regulatory minimums we have to meet. But ultimately, we keep regulatory capital not to keep regulatory authorities happy, but because we need to survive. And if you're that kind of bank, here's what you need to do. You need to look at your assets, if you have loans, how risky they are. You have to ask yourself, what will a bad year look like for us? And set aside enough capital to cover that, even if the regulatory authorities don't even notice you have risky assets. That's a truly prudent bank. And here's my problem with how banking has evolved over the last 70 years. Once the regulatory authority came in and said, we're going to give you a regulatory requirement, banks stepped back and said, we no longer have to worry about risk. The regulatory guys told us what we need to keep. This has become almost a game for many banks, where they look at the regulatory capital ratios and say, how can we fool the capital guys into thinking we have enough capital when we don't? And they won the game, and they kept winning the game until reality hit. Reality ultimately hits in the form of these regulatory, you might be meeting all the regulatory capital requirements, but if you haven't set aside enough capital for that big loss, you're going to be in trouble. So I think banks need to think about the regulatory capital ratios, but they need to also think about how much capital do we need to set aside to cover a really bad year, because that is the reason you keep regulatory capital. So that's a cost of capital approach. Now let's look at what drives optimal debt ratios in this approach. I know you don't look at the attachments I send to my emails. One of these days I'm going to add all kinds of attachments, maybe an attachment that has a final exam on it. And so you didn't see it. I sent it to you 2 weeks ago. And that'll teach you not. But one of the attachments I sent you on the Monday email was a capital structure spreadsheet. And I also sent you a link to a book called The Little Red Hen. And if you read, when you were little kids, any of you read this book? You read about the ant and the grasshopper? No, that's a very old Aesop's fable. The ant and the grasshopper, I can tell you the story. Here's how it works. The ant is this hard-working creature. The grasshopper dances. So all through the summer, the ant is working away, collecting food for the winter. And the grasshopper is having, it's going to party after, just like you guys, party after party after party every evening. Then winter comes along, and of course the party time is over. The ant starts preparing food for winter. The grasshopper comes in and says, I didn't collect any food. Would you share your food with me? And the ant, of course, being an ant, says, no, I did all the work. You didn't work. Therefore, you get no food. The moral of the story is, don't party all summer, because there will be a day when you need to live off your work. You think, what's this got to do with projects? A typical project group is about 5 people in this class. And here's how, I'm not on the inside, so don't think I've got, I'm not like Apple, I'm not watching everything you do through your iPhones. But one person in your group is one of those type A personalities who's actually kept up with this project every week. They're actually ahead of the project. They've actually finished the evaluation, they've got their entire project report all written out. They did it 3 weeks ago. One person is kind of keeping up. One person is thinking about keeping up. One person is like 4 weeks behind, the other person is saying, what project? Right? I mean, this is a typical project. So if you thought about ant and the grasshopper, the first person would be the ant, the fifth person would be the grasshopper, right? And if this were a fair world, the ant would get the A and the grasshopper would get an F and everything would go on. The unfortunate problem, though, is each group gets a grade. So the ant has to take care of the grasshopper. The capital structure spreadsheet I gave you will allow the grasshopper to catch up with the ant in about 3 hours. This is so unfair. Here you have the person who's been working every single week, putting in 2 hours of work. They've got a cost of capital for the company. The grasshopper goes and enters, and the spreadsheet will take all of 15 minutes to enter the numbers. You'll have a cost of capital for the company. You'll have a cost of equity, cost of debt. It'll convert leases to debt. It'll do everything but your wash. And maybe even that will get done. So if you get a chance, I want you to go into that spreadsheet before this weekend. So even if you haven't done any of the other aspects of the project, go in and enter the numbers for your company, and you will have an optimal debt ratio for your company. And that optimal debt ratio can be any number ranging from 0% for some of your companies to as high as 80%. How do I know? Because I have a sense of numbers. By the time that you end up, you'll be reporting the numbers back to me. That's what I expect to see. So what I want to talk about is why some of your companies have really low optimal debt ratios and why some of your companies have really high ones, because that's what I want to see in your project. In your project, if you just tell me my company's optimal debt ratio is 30%, you know what my response is going to be? You took my Excel spreadsheet, you plugged numbers in, you came up with 30%. I really don't learn much more. I want you to tell me why your company has the optimal that it does. So let me give you some ammunition. Here's the first variable that's going to drive your optimal. One of the inputs in that spreadsheet I'm going to ask you is, what's the marginal tax rate on your company? Why? Because that determines the tax benefits of debt. So I took my 4 companies, actually my 5 companies. Well, remember that I did the optimal last week, and I got 40 for one, 30 for others. So I took that, though, my 5 companies, and I changed the tax rate from 0% to 50%. Just to see, holding all else constant, what will happen to my optimal debt ratio as I change my tax rate? So let me state the obvious. As my tax rate decreases, when optimal debt ratio goes down. Why? What's the biggest advantage of debt? It's a tax benefit. So as I lower my tax rate, that benefit decreases. In fact, if I go to a 0% tax rate, these are five very different companies, right? Notice that for every single company, if I go to a 0% tax rate, my optimal debt ratio goes to 0%. So if you're in the Middle East, or your company is a Middle Eastern company, and you're in a country where there are no tax benefits to debt, you can save yourself the spreadsheet, because you're going to get an optimal debt ratio of 0% no matter how much money you make. I could take Aramco. And Aramco makes tons of money, and put it through the spreadsheet, and the optimal debt ratio will still be 0%. So if you don't have taxes, you will have no tax benefits from debt. And if you have no tax benefits, you shouldn't borrow money. Any questions? Second, and this is a big driver of the optimal, is the approach to the optimal that I talked about, the cost of capital approach, is very much predicated on how much you generate as earnings and cash flows as a company. The more you generate as earnings and cash flows, the more I'm going to allow you to borrow. Why? Because that's what you need to use to service debt. So what I'm going to do is measure how much you generate as cash flows, not by in absolute terms, but in percentage terms. Let me give you an example. Does Facebook make a lot of money? In absolute terms, yes, they make about $6 billion. You're saying, that's a lot of money in any terms. What's the market cap for Facebook, though? Does anybody know? Give me a rough sense. It's more than $200 billion. It's $220 billion. If it was $60, I'd be loading up on Facebook stock like it's going out of style. So they make about $6 billion in cash flows, but relative to their market value of $200 billion, $6 billion is about 3%. So they generate, for every $100 in market value, they generate $3 in cash. In contrast, Coca-Cola also has a cash flow of about $6 billion. See, that's not a contrast. It's the same cash flow. But the market cap for Coca-Cola is about $80 billion. So Coca-Cola generates about $7.50 of cash flow for every $100 of value. You're saying, so what? The optimal debt ratio we computed is a percentage number, right? We say 20% of your value. So let's assume that Facebook goes to a 30% debt ratio. That doesn't sound like much, right? So if they go to a 30% debt ratio, 30% of $200 billion is $60 billion, and they're going to have a really tough time servicing that debt with $6 billion in cash flows. So for Facebook, 30% is going to push you too far, so you're probably going to end up with a 10 or a 15 or a 20% optimal. But if you take Coca-Cola and you put in that same $6 billion and you go to a 30% debt ratio for Coca-Cola, 30% of $80 billion is $24 billion, you'll have no trouble servicing $24 billion in debt with $6 billion in cash flows. So when you look across your five or six companies in your group, one of the ratios I'd like you to measure is how much is this company generating in cash flow, and you can define it as EBITDA or EBIT, whatever metric you want to use, as a percentage of the market value of each firm. And the higher that ratio, the higher the optimal debt ratio is going to be. So your tax rate matters, how much you generate in cash flows matter. At the risk of stating the obvious, your risk matters. If you're a risky company, holding all else constant, your optimal debt ratio is going to be lower than if you're a safe company. And it shows up in two places in the capital structure spreadsheet. The first is in your unlevered beta. If you have a low unlevered beta, you can borrow a lot of money and still not see your cost of equity go through the roof because you're building off a really low base. If you have a high unlevered beta, you should be much more careful about borrowing money because if you're Bulgari, unlevered beta of 2.2, and you go out and borrow money, very quickly your beta is going to go to 8, 10, 15. So your unlevered beta measures the risk of your business, and the riskier your business, the more cautious you should be about borrowing money. It also shows up in your cost of debt. Because if you're in a risky business, you might have high cash flows today, but those cash flows could very quickly change. So if I'm a ratings agency rating your company, even though you might have a high interest coverage ratio, I'm going to override that and say, that's good for now, but I don't know whether it'll be there tomorrow, so I'm going to give you a lower rating. That's why technology companies, even if they have really high interest coverage ratios, will often not end up with AAA ratings. They'll end up with AA, AA plus, because ratings agencies kind of hold back on the reliability of that income, the predictability. So your tax rate matters, your cash flows matter, and how risky you are as a company matters. All three are company-specific variables, and variations across these three will cause optimals to vary across companies within a group. But do you think optimals change over time? In other words, if we take this class and I compute the, and in fact, I will do it for you. After you supply your optimals back to me, I will give you the average optimal debt ratio, the median that you came across all your companies. And I've been doing this, as I said, for 20-something years, so I have these averages computed over time. Do you think those averages shift over time? Let's think about why. In fact, I'll give you a story I've been reading for a few months, maybe even a couple of years now, that actually is a false story, but it's a story that has legs because it sounds reasonable. Would you all agree that interest rates are right now are fairly low in the U.S. and Europe? In fact, in much of Europe. They're negative, right? Switzerland is negative. So interest rates are really low. So I'll tell you the story, and you tell me what's wrong with the story. So I open up the Wall Street Journal. It says, because interest rates are low, it's cheap to borrow money. Therefore, companies should be borrowing more money now than 10 years ago. Sounds reasonable, right? First, let's take the first part of the statement. When interest rates are low, does that bring down your cost of debt? Sure, right? Why? How do you get a cost of debt? You take the risk-free rate and you add a default spread. So if the risk-free rate decreases, of course your cost, you're saying, this is true. Companies must be borrowing money like crazy because rates are low. But when you borrow money, what are you not using? You're not using equity, right? When interest rates are low, what happens to the cost of equity? How do you build up to a cost of equity? What do you start with? You start with the risk-free rate, and you add a risk equity risk premium. So when risk-free rates go down, the cost of debt goes down, but what happens to the cost of equity? It also goes down. When interest rates are lower, you shouldn't see optimal debt ratios go up just because rates are lower, because it's like a tide. As it goes up and down, both the cost of equity and the cost of debt will go up and down. But I'll tell you what could cause debt ratios change, and it has. I've seen this happen over the 28 years I've been doing this class. You guys be the bond market. You guys be the equity market. I'm the company. Oh, you be the company. Okay? So you can either raise equity, you can raise debt. If you raise debt, you take the risk-free rate, you add a default spread. That's the price of risk in the bond market. If you raise equity, you take the risk-free rate and you add an equity risk premium. That's the price of risk in the equity market. So there's a price of risk in the bond market. We call it a default spread. The price of risk in the equity market is the equity risk premium. Most of the time, the two move together. What do I mean by that? If there's a crisis, people get scared, default spreads go up, and so do equity risk premiums. So most of the time, you're not going to get an advantage during a crisis saying, I'll borrow money rather than issue equity because both the numbers are going up. But there have been periods, especially in the last 25 years in the U.S., where the two have moved in opposite directions. So let me show you those two periods. This is actually a graph that looks, the blue line is actually the equity risk premium each year. That's the implied equity risk premium. In fact, you saw that several sessions ago when we talked about implied premiums, I showed you that graph. So it actually rose through in the 70s and dropped off in the 90s, rose again during the crisis. So that's, the blue line is the equity risk premium. The black line is actually the default spread on a BAA rated bond. So it's an investment grade bond. Basically, I've just used that to capture how defaults, so the price of risk in the bond market is moving. Most of the time, the two move together. But let me focus in first on the late 90s. Okay, so you're the equity guys, right? Tell me what's happening to the price of risk in the late 90s. You start at about 4.5%, and then you keep drifting down, down, down. By the time you get to the end of 99, you're charging me 2% as a price of risk. So you're the CFO of the company. It's 1999. The equity risk premium is down to 2%. So when you issue equity, they're charging almost nothing for the risk, which means they give you a much higher price. But the default spread, actually, if you look at that same time period, actually went up a little bit rather than go down. So in this five-year period, between 94 and 99, the price of risk in the stock market or the equity market has dropped. The price of risk in the bond market has gone up. So you're the CFO. It's 1999. The price of risk in the equity market is down to 2%. The price of risk in the debt market has pretty much stayed where it was. Would you rather issue debt or equity? You got a 50-50 shot. You want to go to the market where they're charging you very little for risk, or the market where they're charging you a lot for risk? You want to go to the market where you charge very little for risk, because you're, in a sense, they're basically not even charging you for the risk. They're paying this high price for your company, even though it's a risky company. You're going to issue equity like it's going out of style. The late 90s, that's exactly what you saw. That was the peak of the dot-com boom. It was not just technology companies issuing equity. Everybody was issuing equity. Why? Because the price of risk had moved down, and the price of risk in the bond market had gone up. That got adjusted for as the dot-com boom bust. The price of equity risk went back up, and it stayed pretty much up for the next 5, 6, 7 years, around 4%. The cost of debt initially also went up during the dot-com bust, but then you had 9/11. And Alan Greenspan said, I will not let the U.S. economy go into recession. The hubris of central bankers. And the way he did this was to do what was called the Greenspan put. Basically, he pumped money into the bond market, and default spreads in the bond market started to drop. So look at the black line. Between 2001 and 2007, look at what's happening to the price of risk in the bond market. So the bond market guys now have lost their minds. They're now charging less and less and less for risk in the bond market. The equity guys are staying where they used to be. It's 2007. You're the CFO of the same company. You see what you're going to do? You're going to issue debt like it's going out of style. This is the golden age of a leveraged buyout. You borrow money, they're charging you nothing for taking on the risk, and you buy back equity. You're going to walk away a winner. People look at the 2008 crisis, and of course everybody draws their own conclusions. You saw The Big Short, and it's all housing, it's all this, all that, subprime crisis. I'll give you the common theme across all these stories. What was the problem with what bankers and lenders were doing pre-2008? Was it that they were lending to people with bad credit? There's nothing wrong with lending to people with bad credit as long as you charge a high enough interest rate. The subprime crisis was not that you were lending to people who were subprime borrowers. That's been on for a long time. It's that they were lending to subprime borrowers and charging them the interest rate that you would charge safe borrowers. Nothing good can come out of that. And of course, nothing good came out of that. The 2008 crisis was a correction of that bond market back to what it should be charging, which of course was incredibly painful because it carried with it a housing consequence, because a lot of the people who'd borrowed had actually borrowed at too low a rate to buy a house, and now that the housing price had collapsed, they could not refinance at that low rate. And that created the systemic crisis. There are very few market crises in history where you can blame the bond market. Usually the stock market guys who lose their heads. This was one of those few cases where the bond market triggered it. And you can see diverging prices of risk in the bond and the equity market can create consequences for debt ratios. Where are we today? See this purple line? That's actually the ratio of the equity risk premium to the default spread. So basically, I take the equity risk and divide by the spread. When that number is really, really high, okay, it means the equity risk premium is high relative to the default spread. When that number is really, really low, as it was in 99 and 2000, that means the equity risk premium is low relative to the default spread. So what you're looking at today is, are we in a bad place or a good place? And I'll give you some comforting news. The average for that number across the 55 years that I have the data is about 2. The equity risk premium is roughly twice the default spread. And guess what? At the end of 2014, that number was close to 2. So right now, we're pretty much where we would expect to be, but that could change. So right now, I'm not concerned about one market being off sync from the other, but that's the only macro variable that drives your optimal. Any questions on the optimal debt ratio? Yes. No, not a smart investor. I'm talking about the fact that as a CFO, I said you can borrow if you're thinking about raising funding, when the price of risk in the bond market is related to the price of risk in the equity market, as a CFO, you'll borrow more money. As an investor buying an entire company, it's nothing to do with smart. Okay. Well, where's the smart in there, right? All I need to do is take advantage of mispricing in the two markets. I just need to be able to raise the money. If I can raise the money from the bond market at these really low spreads, and then buy equity where I'm paying equity risk premiums similar to the past, I am going to walk away a winner. Not because I was really smart and picked the right company, but because I'm exploiting these different risk prices in the two markets. Well, you can't do an equity buyout, right? So basically what they did then was the companies raised equity and paid down debt, which is the reverse of a leveraged buyout. Instead of raising debt and paying down equity, you raise equity and pay down debt. And so you just reverse the process. So now let's think about what other ways you could come up with the optimal. The approach that I described was called the cost of capital approach. And as I said, when you get a chance, go in and enter your numbers in that spreadsheet. It'll do the whole thing for you, but don't make it a black box. It'll tell you what the actual debt ratio is for your company, what the cost of capital is, the actual. That's the part you were supposed to do 2 weeks ago. It'll get done. It'll show you what the optimal debt ratio for your company is, including the entire schedule from 0 to 90% with the graph that you can create. It'll also tell you what will happen to your value as a firm if you go to the optimal, doing what I did for Disney, and how much your stock price should change if you go and do this recapitalization. So try to get those numbers, because that's going to give you at least the starting point of, does my company have the right mix of debt and equity? Now I'm going to describe a different way of coming up with the optimal debt ratio. You think, why two approaches, more than enough? Well, the third approach I'm going to describe, because there are some people out in consulting firms and investment banks who prefer this approach. In fact, if they went through the University of Chicago, this might be the only approach they were taught, because they're fairly rigid there about this being the right way to think about debt. It's called the adjusted present value approach. In the adjusted present value approach, rather than try to bring the debt into the cost of capital, which is what we did when we computed the cost of capital at different debt ratios, you calculate what the value of the firm would have been if it had been an all-equity funded firm. So basically, you start with a hypothetical. If my firm had been all-equity funded, what would the value be? That's called an unlevered firm value. And then you take the dollar debt that you're thinking about borrowing, and you compute the big plus and the big minus. What am I talking about? What's the big plus of debt again? It's the tax benefits. You compute the tax benefits from the debt. Then the big minus, of course, is you expose yourself to bankruptcy costs. You compute an expected bankruptcy cost. And your value as a firm with debt will then become the unlevered value for the firm, plus the net effect of debt, which is the tax benefit minus the expected bankruptcy cost. That's called the APV approach, and the adjusted present value approach. And there are people who swear by it. So let's look at the steps you need to actually put this approach into practice. The first step is you have to estimate what the value of your company would be if it had no debt. And there are two ways you can do it. One is you can take the cash flows of the company and discount it back at what its cost of capital should have been if it had no debt. Help me out there. If you have no debt, what's your cost of capital going to be? Cost of equity. And what do I compute the cost of equity with? What beta? I use the risk-free rate plus unlevered beta, because there's no debt. So basically, it will be the cost of equity computed with an unlevered beta. So if I take the cash flows to the firm, discount at an unlevered cost of equity, which will also be the cost of capital, I've got the value of the firm with no debt. That's one way to do it. But that does require that you value the whole firm. I'll give you a shortcut if you don't want to go that route. You know the market value of the firm right now, is right? Market value of equity plus debt minus cash, it's out there. Does the market know that you've borrowed money? So if you already have debt, does the market know? Sure, it's on your books, so they know. So in your market value today, there is some tax benefit that the market has built in. And there's some expected bankruptcy cost the market has built in. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, what will happen to your value if you paid off all the debt? So help me out. If I paid off all the debt, what's going to happen to that tax benefit that was built into my value? It's going to go away, so I'm going to subtract it out. But if I paid off, the expected bankruptcy cost that was pushing my value down is also going to go away, so I'm going to add it back. I'm going to come back with an unlevered firm value that's based on your current market value as a company. So that's step one. Step two, I've got to compute the tax benefits of debt. Now, the tax benefit of debt is the interest expense that comes out of the debt and the fact that you get a tax benefit, right? So it's just the tax rate times the interest expense. The present value of that tax savings over time actually boils down to whatever debt you take on times your tax rate. So if you have $2 billion in debt and a 40% tax rate, over time, you're actually going to save about $800 million in taxes, 40% of $2 billion. So I've got my tax savings. So I've got my unlevered firm value. I've got my tax savings. Final piece of the puzzle is I have to estimate the expected bankruptcy cost. And if you remember that discussion we had, there are two components that go into expected bankruptcy cost. The first is the probability that you will go bankrupt, which I have to estimate at different debt ratios. And I'll say the obvious. As you borrow more money, that probability should go up. And the second is the cost of going bankrupt. And if you remember, there are two components to that cost. One is a direct cost, deadweight cost, which occurs because you end up in the legal system. The other cost is this indirect bankruptcy cost. You remember that? People think you're in trouble, your customers stop buying your product. And I'll give you at least a rough sense of what that number is in a minute, but those are the two costs. Yes, Griffin?
Why are you adding back your expected bankruptcy cost? Because if you're eliminating your debt, aren't you also eliminating your expected cost of bankruptcy?
That's right. So that's why I'm adding it back, because it used to be subtracted. When I had the debt, my value was decreased by it. Now that it's left, so I've got to reverse both the good and the bad. So the tax benefit I subtract out because the market added it in. And the expected bankruptcy cost, I have to add back. So I'm just reversing what the market has done, saying, hey, the debt's not there. I should reverse those. So you have an expected bankruptcy cost. The unlevered firm value is pretty straightforward. The tax benefit is a no-brainer. The expected bankruptcy cost is a nightmare. Nightmare to estimate. So when you see people using the adjusted present value approach in practice, and I'm talking about bankers and consultants, here's what happens. They do the unlevered firm value. And they might stretch a few rules, but they get it done. They do the tax benefit, no problem. Then they get the expected bankruptcy cost, and they start waving their hands. And after they waved it for a long enough time period, they say, too difficult to do. Let's act like it's not there. So let me cut to the chase. In APV... in practice, here's what you get. You get the unlevered firm value plus the tax benefit, and you just stop. If that's the way you use APV, what's going to happen to the value of your company as you borrow more money? You're counting all the good stuff, right? You're counting none of the bad stuff. So as you borrow more money, you will always see your value go up. No wonder LBO guys love the APV approach. Because it confirms it. I borrowed 90. Look, my value just went up. I call this the half-assed APV approach. And I've never in my life seen somebody who claims to use the APV approach actually do it right. Ever. They all use this half-assed approach, claim to have done an adjusted present value, and expect you to buy into their conclusion saying, hey, it's two-thirds is better than nothing at all, so this is pretty good. I'd rather you not do it at all if you're not going to bring in the expected bankruptcy cost. You're going to run into some of these people as you get out there. And I'm going to give you the ammunition to defang them. Because here's what I'm going to take you through. I'm going to take you through how to do the APV right. And then you can say, well, maybe I should make your half-assed APV into a full APV so it actually works. So here's what I need to bring in. I need to bring in two numbers. I need a probability of bankruptcy that I've got to bring into the process. And I've got to bring in a bankruptcy cost. Here's how I'm going to estimate the probability of bankruptcy. Remember the cost of capital approach? I estimated a synthetic rating at every debt ratio using the interest coverage ratio. So as you borrowed more money, your rating went from AAA to single C. At the end of every year, for the last 20-something years, Ed Altman, who teaches, he's an emeritus, he's just retired, but he's been teaching here a long time. At the start of every year, here's what he does. He goes back 10 years, and he collects all the rated bonds then, and he classifies them from AAA down to D. And he looks at what percentage of bonds in each ratings class actually fail over the next 10 years. So it's a very simple table. And here's what the table looked like. So you're going to see that table. That table is what I'm going to use to come up with that estimated probability of bankruptcy. I'm going to use the synthetic rating to come up with the probability of default. So that's actually not going to be that difficult. The cost of bankruptcy has two parts to it. The direct cost is actually not difficult to estimate. It's about 5 to 10% of value, and it seems to cut across companies. Doesn't matter whether you're a manufacturing company or a service company, the lawyers will take about 5 to 10% of your value if you go bankrupt. The indirect cost of bankruptcy is the nightmare. That's like nailing jello to a wall. It's a number that could be very low for a grocery store and very high for an airplane manufacturer. Remember, we talked about the fact that if you're a durable good manufacturer, it's, you know, your rating drops. It could be anywhere from close to 0% to more than 30%. That's the item that people get stuck on, and there is very little that we can use to estimate it better. But undaunted, I'm going to try anyway. I need those two numbers to use the APV approach. Here's the table that I'm going to use to estimate the probability of default. So this is the Altman table that I talked about. At every rating, I tell you the probability that bonds in that rating will fail. So if you're a D-rated company, you're already in default, so that's easy, 100%. If you're a C-rated company, sometime in the next 10 years, there's an 85% chance you will default. No surprise. And as the rating improves, the probabilities get lower. Remember when I talked about the Nabisco fiasco? I talked about the fact that no AAA-rated company or a AA-rated company had ever defaulted while it was rated AA. That is true still. But notice in this table that even a AAA-rated bond, you know, if you look at it over 10 years, 0.07% of those bonds default. Not a very high percent, but you should expect it to. AA, about 0.51% default. So there's a chance of default even at very high ratings. It just is lower than what it is at lower ratings classes. So what I'm going to do at every debt ratio is I'm going to estimate your rating and use this table to look up the probability of default. Now comes the cost of bankruptcy. What I'm going to do is take Disney to kind of illustrate this process. So first, I'm going to try to compute the unlevered firm value using that shortcut I talked about. The market value for Disney as a company, market value of equity plus market value of debt, is about $137.8 billion. So that's the existing market value of Disney with its existing debt of $15.96 billion. So what am I planning to do? I'm planning to pay off the debt. If I pay off the debt, here's what I'm going to lose. I'm going to lose the tax benefit I'd have got in the 15.96, which is the 15.96 billion times the 36.1% tax rate. So I'm going to lose $5.76 billion in tax benefits. So is everybody comfortable with what I'm doing? I'm saying if they pay off the debt, what's going to happen? I'm going to lose the tax benefits. But if I pay off the debt, the one bonus I get is the expected bankruptcy cost that was built into my market value is also going to go away. Disney's actual rating was single A. And if you go back to the previous page, a single A rated company, the probability of default is 0.66%. That's what I made the probability of bankruptcy. So that's now going to go away because they're paying off the debt. The cost of bankruptcy, I assumed, would be 25% of Disney's value. The 5 to 10% is the fixed cost. Do you see what I've done? I said the range on the indirect bankruptcy cost is anywhere from 0 to 30. I've gone right down the middle. So ask me the question. Why 25%? I'll ask myself the question since you didn't. No. The honest answer is, why not? That's the weakness of the APU approach. This is the weakest link because this number is so difficult to estimate that you're kind of making it up as you go along. In a few minutes, I'll give you a cynical chance to be able to see why I might have used 25%, but I used 25%, so I put it right in the middle. I'm saying it's neither Boeing nor a grocery store. It's in the middle. It's about 25%. My unlevered firm value is $132.3 billion. What does that mean? If Disney paid off all of their debt tomorrow and made themselves an all-equity funded firm, their value will drop from 137.8 to 132.3 billion. Any questions so far? Now let me complete the rest of the story. So what I did was I took debt ratios from 0 to 90%. In fact, this dollar debt was what I used in the last session to come up with the cost of capital approach. The only difference here is instead of using it to come up with the cost of capital, what I use it instead is to come up with the tax benefits of debt, which is just the dollar debt times the tax rate, and the expected bankruptcy cost. So here's what's happening. As my debt ratio rises, my rating drops. No surprise. As my rating drops, the probability of default rises from 0.07% to 85%. As my probability of default goes up, my expected bankruptcy cost climbs. My value as a firm is $132.3 billion. That remains a constant. Plus the tax benefit minus the expected bankruptcy cost, what you see in the last column, is my levered value for the firm. What's my objective in corporate finance? Maximize value, right? So if I stay true to that objective, where should I stop? 40%. which incredibly, coincidentally, is equal to what I came up with as an optimal with the cost of capital approach. Now let your cynical side go crazy. Why did I use 25%? Maybe I used 15, and I came up with a much higher optimal, and I said, how am I going to explain this in class? It would be nice if the numbers were much closer. So I tried 35%, and I came up with too low a number. I said, that's so inconvenient. I'm not saying this is what I did, but you have no way of knowing. Maybe I picked the 25% because it would give me this nice, convenient result. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you the Excel spreadsheet for the adjusted present value. You play with the indirect bankruptcy cost, and you see what you would need to come up with a debt ratio that matches up to your cost to capital approach. I'm not a great believer in the APV approach, and you can see why. So when people try to bludgeon you with the APV approach, be ready. You can see what its limitations are. Focus on its weakest link, which is this bankruptcy cost. And if they haven't thought about it, it's really not an APV approach. Any questions? So we've talked about the cost of capital approach. We've talked about the enhanced cost of capital approach. We've talked about the adjusted present value approach. None of these approaches are rocket science, right? They're tedious. They might have a few layers to them. But you don't need to be a mathematical genius to get any of them. So you'd think companies, for the most part, would use one or more of these approaches to come up with their optimal debt ratios. But I'm going to let you in on what I think is the dirty little secret of capital structure. Most companies, if you ask them, how did you come up with your debt ratio? I'm not going to tell you I tried a cost of capital approach and this is my best mix. They're going to say, we use this debt ratio because most other companies in our sector are around this debt ratio. I call this Me Too corporate finance. And here's why it's Me Too corporate finance. You ask CFO, why are you borrowing 30%? Because everybody else is, but Me Too. There's no good reason why their debt ratio is what it is other than they want to be just like the rest of the sector. So I have a very simple question. This is not just capital structure. If you look at why companies pay the dividends that they do, you know what the most easiest way to explain it is? Look at what other companies in the sector are paying in dividends, and you can very quickly explain why the company does what it does. I wonder why you need CFOs, to be quite honest. You take an Excel spreadsheet, you take the peer group, you put the average in, you let it run, right? Because that's effectively what you're doing. So what is this? Why do you think companies want to be close to the average? In other words, you know things are going to go wrong, no matter what approach you use. If you use a cost of capital approach and things go wrong, they blame you. If you use the peer group approach and things go wrong, you say, hey, everybody made the same mistake. It's like a six-year-old's excuse for doing anything. I remember when my youngest was six, he came home from school and he'd done something that he shouldn't have done. I don't even remember what it is. So I asked him, Kieran, why would you do something stupid like that? He said, because everybody else was doing it, Dad. And of course, his mom jumps in with the quintessential mom question, which is, everybody else jumped off the bridge, would you jump off the bridge too? To which any normal six-year-old, you know what the answer is going to be? Of course, Mom, do you want me to look strange? That's the same thing companies are doing with their debt ratios. There's no good reason. They're doing it because everybody else does it, and if they don't do it, they're afraid of looking different. So I don't fight this. I know that this is going to come. In fact, all you can do is kind of work this to your advantage. Because if you're going to look at the industry, might as well do it sensibly. Sensibly in what sense? If you're Ryanair, what business are you in? The airline business, right? So when you pull up the peer group, you're going to go to a lot of other airlines. Your debt ratio is low. Everybody else has a high debt ratio. This is bad, right? You should move your debt ratio up. But before you move your debt ratio up, what should hold you back? Why is your debt ratio low? Because your tax rate is 12.5% and it's Continental United, it's 35%. So if you're going to be like the peer group, at least stop and ask, why am I different? Maybe there's a good reason. I'm going to show you what Disney looks like relative to the entertainment sector. But here's the big difference. Disney is like no other company in that sector. In fact, Disney and Time Warner kind of stand out. They're big, conglomerate, multi-business entertainment companies. Most of the entertainment companies are small, single-business entertainment companies. Holding all else constant, I would actually expect Disney to have a higher debt ratio than everybody else because it should be a safer business. So what I'm saying is if you want to compare yourself to the sector, at least ask those questions. What's my tax rate? Should I be at the same debt ratio as everybody else? Should I be higher or should I be lower? So let me show you the numbers for my companies. And in this case, at least, it's pure coincidence. Here on Cook the Numbers, I got some incredibly convenient results. And I'll explain. Remember, I don't know whether you remember, but last session when I went through the optimals for my four companies, here's what I found. I think Disney was at 11.6% debt ratio. Its optimal was 40%. It was significantly under-levered. Tata Motors and Vale were over-levered. They had too much debt. And Baidu was about where I'd expect to be. At like a 5% debt ratio, the optimal is 10%. So let's say I get in front of Disney. I present this cost of capital approach. I say, you should have more debt. And the CFO puts up and says, if we do this, will we look strange? So I went and looked at the rest of the sector. So what I did was I compared Disney to U.S. entertainment companies. Those are Disney's debt ratios. You're saying, why are there four debt ratios? I computed every conceivable debt ratio because the CFO might have his own measures. I used book value and market value. I looked at gross debt and net debt. I came up with four debt ratios. I did those same four debt ratios for U.S. entertainment companies. So what was my recommendation to Disney? That they should borrow more money, right? You see how this result is going to be very convenient to me? Not only are they under-levered relative to the cost of capital optimal, but they have less debt than the rest of the sector, even though they're bigger and safer. Saying, yeah. So if you want to be like the rest of the group, you should borrow more money. With Vale and Tata Motors, I use global mining and global automobile companies as my comparison. And here again, my recommendation to those two companies is they have too much debt, they should pay it down. Well, here again, the results were very convenient. Their debt ratios were higher than the industry average on pretty much every dimension. Right? There might be one or two. So Vale's debt ratios are higher. So I'm saying, so here again, my suggestions or recommendations are going to be backed up by saying, if you do this, you're going to look more like the sector rather than less. And with Baidu, I kind of hedged. I wasn't on that spot where I said, you're pretty close, you're optimal. And if you look at the results, it actually is, its debt ratio is actually higher than the rest of the sector. In fact, if you look at the rest of the sector, notice the net debt ratios are negative. What does that mean? When does the net debt ratio become negative? First, what's net debt? It's debt minus cash. That's what net debt is. Okay? So when you have a negative net debt ratio, these companies actually have much bigger cash balances than they have debt, which means they've hit zero and kept going. They're even lower than a zero debt ratio. So here, the sector is actually at no debt. You're at some debt. So Baidu CFO might say, hey, it looks like I have too much debt, not too little. Should I be paying off my debt? And then I have to come back with some ammunition. And it turns out about 2/3 of those companies in the sector are money-losing companies. Baidu makes about $2 billion a year. I would expect Baidu to borrow some money, even though the rest of the sector doesn't, simply because it's one of those companies in the sector that actually makes money, partly because it's protected from competition. So when you think about the rest of the sector, you can look at these numbers, and sometimes they will help your case, and sometimes they might get in your way, because you might come to the conclusion that a company is under-levered. It's too little debt on the cost of capital approach. But if they end up having more debt than the industry, the CFO is going to push back saying, well, I'm already over-levered. Look, and I blame equity research analysts because they're equally lazy on this dimension. They compare debt ratios to the sector, and they say, you have too little debt. Your debt ratio is lower than the average. It's incredibly sloppy. It's incredibly sloppy because you're throwing away so much data. You know what I mean by throwing away? I have 50 companies. I have the debt ratios for every company. I compute the average, and I use only the average. What is this, 1955? You have the rest of the data. Play some money ball with the data, and that's what I'm going to do next. I'm going to say, look, I have all these companies. Why would I want to look just at the average? Why can't I come up with a more refined way of estimating what a company should borrow? You say, what are you talking about? When did you take your statistics? Everybody here has taken statistics already, right? Everybody here has forgotten their statistics already. You were convinced that this was it. In fact, how many of you sold your book back the minute that class ended? This is one of the great tragedies of statistics. You say, this is the most useless class ever. Even if you sold your book, let me ask you a question. Do you remember that chapter on multiple regressions or that session? You don't, right? What do you do in a multiple regression? Somebody described to me in very generic ways what a multiple regression is. Don't miss the biggest thing. There is a dependent variable. The dependent variable is actually the heart of a multiple regression. It's a variable you're trying to explain, and the independent variables are the variables that you think might help you explain the dependent variable. It's the essence of multiple regression. So let's bring this into our discussion. What's a variable that we're trying to explain? Debt ratios, right? What are we worried about? Differences in tax rates, differences in risk. What if I ran a regression of debt ratios? I have 50 entertainment companies. I have a big Excel spreadsheet, right? In fact, you don't even have to know how to run a regression. You just have to know what cells to pick in Excel, pick that thing, and it shows up as great output. So debt ratio is my dependent variable. My independent variables are the tax rate. Why? Because higher tax rate companies should have higher debt ratios. Variable in earnings, because high risk companies should have lower debt ratios. And maybe how much you produce in cash flows, and I'm going to capture it with this EBITDA number, just like I did earlier. So I run the regression. It's a regression with real data. You might come to the conclusion nothing works, in which case, move on. You can still use the average. But if you find, for instance, across these companies that high tax rate companies have high debt ratios, high risk companies have low debt ratios, you know what you can do? You can take your company's tax rate. If you're Ryanair, take your company's tax rate, your company's earnings variability, and your company's cash flow, plug it into the regression, you will get a predicted debt ratio for your company. You think, no way it's going to happen. Let's try it. I'm going to try this for Tata Motors. For Tata Motors, when I pulled up comparable companies, I ended up with this Excel spreadsheet of 56 automobile companies, some big, some small, some risky, some safe, very different companies. So I had Volkswagen in this sample, and I also had some really small emerging market automobile companies in the sample, all in that spreadsheet. Now I could just compute the average and say I'm done, which is what I showed in the previous table. But here I decided to run a regression of the debt to capital ratios of these 56 companies against the effective tax rate of each company, against how much they generated its cash flows with the EBITDA, and how much these companies were investing in capital expenditure. My rationale for including that is if you're a growing automobile company and you have a lot of CapEx, you're going to be a little more careful about using debt because all your value is in the future. I ran the regression and I got an R squared of 21%. That good, bad, indifferent? Statistics classes ruin you for life. Because everything in statistics classes have R squareds of 95%. Somehow statistics professors seem to think that if you don't have an R squared of 95%, you're not going to be convinced. So you start doing things where you test the obvious. Is there a relationship between how much I eat and how much I weigh? Yes. So if you eat 50,000 calories a day, you are going to weigh 600 pounds. Okay, we've concluded that. Is there a relationship between how much I drink and what my GPA is? Absolutely. You drink more than 50 beers a week, your GPA is going to be non-existent because you're never in class. But it's exactly that kind of thing you run in statistics classes, things that everybody knows. And of course, the R-squared is going to be 95%. So I'm not going to aspire for 95%. Am I happy with 21%? To me, the level of the R-squared is kind of, I don't know what a good R-squared is, but I'll tell you how it affects me. In this regression, I plugged in the values for Tata Motors into the regression. You can do that with any regression. I come up with a predicted value of 18.54%. Now, that's a predicted value, right? If the R-squared were 100%, the 18.54% would be the perfect predicted value. If my R-squared were 80%, the range around the 18.54% would be about plus or minus 1.5%. So it would be like 17. So do you see how R-squareds matter? They matter by spreading the range around my predicted value. With a 21% R-squared, the range I get on my prediction is that the debt ratio for Tata Motors should be plus or minus 13.5% to 23.5%, plus or minus 5% in each direction. You think that's big? Well, that's what a low R squared does. But here's why it still matters. Based on my regression, noisy though it is, I'm saying Tata Motors' debt ratio should be somewhere between 13.5% and 23.5%, right? Its actual debt ratio was 29%. I can still conclude Tata Motors has too much debt. So don't give up because your R-squared on your regression is low. You can still use it. You can get a range. And sometimes that range might be big, but that doesn't mean you can't jump to the next step and say, in spite of having a big range, I can tell you what this company is in terms of being under or over leveraged. So that's the R-squared. The regression to me is just a tool that I can use to bring the storytelling into fruition by looking at how it plays out. So that's with the sector. So let's assume you're looking at a company and you're only five companies in your sector. You can't run a regression. There aren't enough observations, right? So you'd like to expand the sample. Here's one way you can expand the sample. Why don't you look at the entire market? There are thousands of stocks listed. Your multiple regression will then be across thousands of companies. And at the start of every year, I run this regression for the entire market. I'll send you the results of this regression later today. I run it for U.S. companies. I run it for global companies. Of debt ratios against the effective tax rate. So in this particular regression was the effective tax rate, the percent of shares held by institutions, the variation in operating income to capture the risk in the stock, and how much they generate as cash flows. Before you get too excited about this really big regression, the R squared is 8%. You say, oh, that's awful. Remember, I wanted to use the cost of capital approach to come up with the optimal, and you said you'd like to use the sector debt ratios. You chose your poison. Now I'm feeding it to you. All these R squareds are doing is holding a mirror up to reality. It's not my fault that the R squared is low. It's that there's a lot of noise in how companies pick debt ratios, and you are choosing to base your debt ratio on what everybody else does. To me, this is a warning sign to you. If you're basing your debt ratio on other companies, that you should not be. I'd like you to go back to cost of capital approach, but if you decide to stay in this particular section of the market, or this particular approach, I'm just saying be careful. There's lots of variation across companies. And there's no good reason sometimes for why companies do what they do. But the regressions are a tool. They're not going to replace your analysis, but they're one more thing you can bring to the table to decide whether your company has the right debt ratio. So I took that market regression. I plugged the numbers in for Disney. So this is that market regression you saw on the previous page. I plugged the numbers in for Disney, and I came up with a predicted debt ratio for Disney of about 19%. Let me pause right there. With an 8% R squared, the range around that is going to be pretty hefty. Let's say it's 12 to 25. What is that? If I asked you to describe this predicted value to somebody who knows no statistics, intuitively, what is that 18.86% describing? What is that telling you? Given how other companies in the market are setting debt ratios, and given Disney's specific characteristics, this is what I'd expect Disney to borrow, about 19%. That's all it is. It's a conditional statement. It's your deciding to be, it's your me too debt ratio carried to its logical limit. You want to be like everybody else? Here's what the rest of the market is doing, and given your differences, this is what your debt ratio should be. So let's say you do this regression, you come up with this debt ratio. Would you expect it to be roughly what you got from the cost of capital approach? So let's say you do this for hundreds of companies. You got your optimal debt ratio from the cost of capital approach, the debt ratio from the regression. Would you expect the two to kind of converge? Or let me rephrase the question. What has to be true for the two numbers to converge? Everybody's not using the cost of capital. Everybody's picking debt ratios sensibly. In other words, if everybody's doing the rational way of coming up with debt ratios, the two will converge. You see where I'm going next? I'll give you, in fact, a story to bring home how the two numbers can diverge. The mid-90s, I went to Seoul. That was the first time I'd been in Seoul, South Korea, to do a two-day corporate finance session. And whenever I go into country, I pick 10 companies in that country, and I take them through this process, just like I did. So I took the 10 Korean companies I had, Hyundai, Samsung, etc. I did the optimal debt ratios for all of these companies. I came up with optimal debt ratios of between 30 and 40% for most of the companies. They're big, mature holding companies. Then I looked at the actual debt ratios, and every single one of these companies had actual debt ratios of 70 to 80%. So company one, company two, company three, every company. You think, what's going on? The Korean government in the mid-90s used to give implicit guarantees when companies borrowed money. So if you were Hyundai, you went to the bank to borrow money. You were borrowing based on your assets, right? But during the mid-90s, the Korean government, because it wanted the economy to grow fast, gave an implicit guarantee to banks saying, if you lend to Hyundai and they're not able to pay you, we'll step in and make up the difference. So if you think about the trade-off, you see what's already happened? You borrow money as Hyundai, you get tax benefits, you get to keep the tax benefits. But who's bearing the bankruptcy costs? Well, the taxpayers are. You've effectively pushed you've tilted the scales. So Korean companies were doing exactly what they should do rationally, which is borrow too much. Clearly, they were borrowing too much. You know what caused that to kind of implode in 96 and 97? The Korean government meant this implicit guarantee to work if one or two companies got into trouble. They never thought everybody would get into trouble at the same time. So the Hyundai gets into trouble, not a problem, we'll cover it. Turned out that in 97, all the Korean conglomerates all got into trouble at the same time. The Korean government looked around and said, you know what, guys, that implicit guarantee, forget about it. Collectively, Korean companies, it took about 3 years to dig back to where they needed to be. So if you have companies across a market borrowing too much or too little, you're going to see this when you run this regression, because you're going to get numbers that are either much higher or much lower than what you're getting with the optimal debt ratio. It's actually a great way to see if an entire market has lost its mind in terms of borrowing too much or too little. Yes, Justin?
Why should you care what the market does? Because this is like a cost of capital approach for the enhanced.
Why should you care what the market does? I mean, but that's what they're doing. I'm not even saying I'm caring about it. That's what everybody else is doing. You're saying, why should you care what everybody else is doing? You're a CFO, though. And you want... I'll give you one rule about business in general, particularly true on Wall Street. If you're going to be wrong, make sure you have lots of company. Because the worst thing you can do is to be wrong alone. And that's at the heart of why CFOs behave the way they do. You might be right 70% of the time with the cost of capital approach and wrong only 30% of the time. But the 30% of the time you're wrong, you might look like a strange outlier. So you're going to get punished for all the wrong reasons. So it's the way we set up the incentive systems and how we compare CFOs. Yes?
When you talk about Korea, you said that when they brought too much money, what exactly caused that?
Well, the fact that you had a recession. Recession caused the earnings for all. So it wasn't a one company mistake. It was collectively the earnings for these. So it was the 97 Asian crisis, right? It kind of froze the earnings across the board, across all of Asia. Korean companies across the board saw their earnings drop off. So Hyundai was in trouble, Samsung was in trouble, everybody was in trouble. And the Korean government said, we don't have enough money to cover all of you guys. You're on your own. Okay. Yes?
So it seems like you're painting a very pessimistic picture for our professional life. You're teaching us the proper way to do...
I'm not saying. I'm being a realist. I'm saying once you get out there, the urge to be me too is going to be incredibly strong.
Sure, yeah.
Okay?
And what would you give as advice to
be independently wealthy? So I'm afraid that that's the way the working. So be a realist when you get out there, which is people around you will do things when you look at them and say, that doesn't make sense. But before you jump to that conclusion, think through the fact that they have other incentives playing out. They're not sitting there saying, what's a maximizer? What will maximize the firm value? They're saying, what will maximize my job life at this company? So I'm just saying be a realist, because I see people get frustrated. They go there, the managing director asks them to use PE ratios to price companies. But that's not how I learned to value companies. You have to realize that people's incentives are going to be driven by how they get rewarded and their fears, and that is going to drive people towards a me too approach. And when you're a low person on the totem pole, don't do stupid things. Like say, not me too. Wait till if you can rise up the ranks, maybe you can change the rules a little bit. Because there are companies that do the sensible thing. And initially, analysts hate these companies. I mean, look at Amazon. For 20 years, they've broken the rules for how a company should deal with Wall Street. But in spite of that, they've succeeded. Why? Because they've had a management team that has had a story that it stayed consistent with, both in terms of saying the same story over and over again and acting on that story. So I think it can be done. I just think it will take work, and you will have to find the right place. So if you are uncomfortable because of that Me Too-ism in a company, then you might have to look for a place where you don't have to do the Me Too-ism as much. But if you're okay with me, you're a really good Me Too-er, go for it. Really good Me Too-er, right up the ranks, you become a managing director of an investment bank. Your pathway is set. There's a very good class. Me Too-ers, all you have to do is watch and copy. Think like a six-year-old. What's everybody else doing? I'm going to do exactly the same thing. I'm not going to deviate from the script. It's a very simple. It's just you have to your observation skills. Just watch people, and you have to kind of be a chameleon, adjust to whatever's happening around you. So I don't teach a Me Tooism class because there's no class. It's not a theory class. It's really being observant. So let me summarize the numbers I have for my five companies. I have lots of these different approaches, but luckily the numbers kind of gel. I have the actual debt ratio in the first column for all four of my companies. With Disney, every single one of my approaches, the cost of capital approach, the enhanced cost of capital approach, the APV approach, every single one of them delivered a number higher than my actual. So for Disney, it's completely, it's categorical. They have too little debt. For Vale, I had a 35.48%, a little more mixed, but relative to most of the numbers, they are slightly over-levered. That number, of course, has become a lot worse as iron ore prices have collapsed. Tata Motors, again, every single one of the numbers I got from the approaches gave me a lower optimal than their actual, so they're clearly over-levered. And Baidu, it's kind of in the middle. The traditional approaches say you can borrow a little more, but the industry average says you shouldn't borrow as much. So I'm probably just going to leave them alone. So don't, no, nothing to do here. Don't go out and borrow money. It's just going to make you look stranger. Nothing much is gained by going to that 10%. So in a sense, that's what you're looking for is don't give me five optimals and you pick. You got to pick. This is your choice to make. Pick the one that reflects what you want to do. I know you guys want to get out of here, but I'm going to get the next part of this process started. Okay? We've got the optimal mix of debt and equity, right? So we go through mechanics, and my optimal is 30 and 40%. I want to talk about the process of what to do next. So now that you have an optimal for your company, what exactly is the next step to get from the actual to the optimal? So we're going to talk about two issues. One is, if your actual is different from the optimal, should you move to the optimal, and if so, how quickly? And the second is, if you decide to move to the optimal, what kind of debt should you use to get there? Long-term, short-term, fixed rate, floating rate, US dollar, euro, whatever the choices are. So let me at least set up the process. So let's say this weekend you actually listen to me, you put the numbers in for your company, you come up with an optimal debt ratio for your company. One of three things is going to end up being true. One is your company might be one of those rare companies whose actual debt ratio is pretty close to the optimal. And let me be very clear. If you remember how I did the optimal, I went 0, 10%, 20%, I gave you an optimal. And during the last 48 hours, I've got emails from people who might be a little too precision-oriented saying, why don't you optimize? Why don't you give us the exact optimal? Because you could do it, right? Gold seek in Excel. I could have told you the optimal debt ratio for Disney is 41.5865%. You know why I'd never want to do that? There's no more dangerous game to play in finance than the game that I call the game of precision when precision is not even there. I'm going to stop with 40% because I know my inputs are my inputs. I could be wrong. So I'm going to leave you at the 40%. So if your actual is 36.58 and the optimal is 40, don't do crazy things like my company is massively underlevered. They should go out and borrow money. It's not. Within rounding, it is at the optimal. And if you're at the optimal, what advice should you give a company? Do no harm. It's a Hippocratic oath, right? What I mean by that is when you go into a company and your actual is equal to the optimal, you're going to say, but I have nothing interesting to say about my company. I should say something. This is the consultant's disease. If a consultant goes into a company, it's already well run. He has two things, right? He can tell the company, you're doing everything right, but then they're going to say, well, why did we hire you in the first place? So you know what consultants do? They provide you 15 pages of things you could do, most of which will damage you. But they feel this urge to give you advice because that's what... So don't go down that road. If your company is already at top, just let it go. You got lucky. There are, of course, two other scenarios. Your company could have too little debt or too much debt. If you're going to have a problem, which one would you rather have? Too little debt. It's a much more pleasant problem to have. Think like an individual. Would you rather have the credit agencies chasing you because you couldn't make your last payment, or would you rather have credit card companies chasing after you because they want you to take their credit cards? It's a no-brainer. It's better to be under-levered than over-levered. And once you make the judgment, you have to follow that up by asking, how quickly do I need to get to the optimal? And what's the right kind of debt that I should use to get from where I am to the optimal? So that's going to be what we'll do in the next session. We'll start the next session by by looking at a framework for getting from the actual debt ratio to the optimal debt ratio, and then follow up by looking at what kind of debt is the right debt for my company. So please do enter the numbers in the capital structure spreadsheet and come up with the optimal. Bring it with you to class on Monday, because then as I do Disney, you can start looking at your company and start working through this process in class.
Goes with the local currency.
Yes.
Inflation doesn't go with countries, it goes with currencies.
Right.
I can take a Zimbabwean company and do the product in the US dollar. In this case, inflation is the US dollar inflation. Mm-hmm. Inflation comes from a currency choice.
Yeah, but the process for the. For
so you haven't
wise? So you have based off of the local currency.
Can
we just convert that?
It's controlled. Yeah.
Like the US and then just use the US.
Yeah. Currency is a choice, it's a measurement. You're not saying the cash flows are going to be US dollars, you're saying they're in the local currency, but by the time I convert them, this is what they're going to look like in US dollars.
Okay, so you suggest if I had like the unadjusted for inflation revenues for every year, I would just convert that in local currencies.
When you say unadjusted for inflation, what do you mean?
So it's literally just the raw values. They haven't been adjusted for inflation. We just estimated, okay, we're going to make this much this year, this much this year.
So constant unit prices.
Yes.
So basically there's no inflation built into them yet.
Not yet.
So what you do then is build in a 2% inflation or 1.5% inflation for the US dollar inflation.
Right.
And make sure your discount rate is in US dollars.
Okay, so the discount rate is in US dollars. Then at which point should we convert it to the US currency?
Do it right away.
Oh, so okay, so unadjusted in US currency, and then...
No, there's no new conversion to make it all. It's not in any currency, because there's no inflation there. It's currency free. You see what I'm saying? If it had been in the Ethiopian currency, you'd see this huge jump from year to year. So if you don't have inflation, it's almost currency free. It's neutral. It's a real cash flow. So you can convert into any currency you want by taking inflation. So you're actually, that's good that they gave you real, because if they give you the Ethiopian currency, then you'd have had to get those forward exchange rates like I did for, if you remember, for the Disney theme park where I converted using the expected. So this is actually good. It'll make your life easier that they gave it to you in real cash flows, because all you have to do is put in the US dollar inflation rate, use it, and be very specific.
I mean, this we calculate it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Aircraft at least.
Okay, so
at least.
So first one.
did you include leases when you unlevered when you did the rest of the companies, or did you not include leases?
I just took like the total debt averages from like all the capital, like different.
Okay, then you didn't include leases. So when you do the levered beta for your company, you have to look at the debt without the leases.
Okay, so I think that's what I did. Like, I just took like the total debt.
Yeah, then you'll be
able. But not the market value. I guess so.
That's okay. That's not going to make much of a difference. Unless you want to convert everything to market values, don't do market values.
Okay, I did market values to get that cost of capital.
That's
after
fine.
I have
after you have that. So once you have the levered beta, you can go back to market values.
Okay.
I'm going to walk up. Why don't you guys walk up with me? Because I have to catch a flight to catch. So
come. Which way?
This way.
Oh, okay. Wow.